like this one. It's very smooth. Look at the nice lines.
Smooth.
Did she crack the other one? Is that the problem?
Yeah, what happened?
She broke it over my head the other day.
Oh,
I
was wondering.
Okay.
Huffman's getting an education. Come to order.
To do that.
Welcome to our committee. It's a fun place to be. If you are here and you have a cell phone with you, as most people do, please make sure that it is turned all the way to silent. And of course, don't use it while you're driving in your car. I will open a public hearing, and we are going to take Senator Bonamici is coming in at 1:30. So wherever we are in the agenda, we're going to pause at 1:30 so that we can take testimony from Senator Bonamici, who is coming to talk about the OEB bill. She understands it better than anyone else, and she's in another committee at that time. So apologies in advance if you are interrupted. We'll finish whatever panel is up there, but then we'll bring Senator Bonamici up. So I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 78.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, before you is SB 70. This is a measure that specifies the amount the state school fund the Department of Education shall receive for instruction of certain hospitalized children and children in long-term care or treatment. Does declare an emergency. There was an amendment also that further modifies the formula in terms of how you calculate those sums. We do have the fiscal and the revenue back with respect to that amendment, and I believe the panel here can speak to that as well.
Thank you. Please, go ahead.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and joining me today are Eric Richards and Steve Smith from our Office of Student Learning and Partnerships. We're here today to ask for your support of Senate Bill 70 with the Dash 3 amendment, and as your committee administrator so ably explained, it does change the way state school fund payments are calculated for some of our most vulnerable students who are in hospital programs or long-term care and treatment programs. So, just to provide a little bit of background and context, as many of you probably know, the department is charged with overseeing the educational services for children who are hospitalized with severe physical or mental illnesses. So we have long-term care and treatment programs. A lot of these kids are, this is somewhat related to the topic that we discussed on Monday with Chuck Bennett's bill, but The long-term care and treatment kids are placed a lot of times by the Oregon Youth Authority Department of Human Services. And then we have hospitals that serve as educational hubs for students who are injured, Dornbeck or Emmanuel, the Shriners Hospital. So with our testimony, we've sort of included a list of all the hospital programs and then a list of all the long-term care and treatment providers. I believe there's about 50 long-term care and treatment providers. We contract with 29 school districts and ESDs to provide the services to those kids. So again, it's making sure that, you know, while a student's being treated or while a student's recovering from illness or injury, that they can continue their education and get those services. So Senate Bill 70A, what we need to do, frankly, Madam Chair, for about the last 15 years, the department has been incorrectly calculating the way we draw down state school fund dollars for these programs. And what has been the practice in the past is that we've drawn down based on the number of slots available, so the number of spaces that need to be available in the hospitals or the long-term care and treatment programs to provide services to do that. And current law only allows payment to be drawn down by average daily membership. So during the 2007-2009 biennium, our staff, Steve at the end of the dais here with me, and some of his folks discovered this, that we have been doing this for about a decade and a half incorrectly. For the current school year, we have been doing it correctly and making up the lost revenue with reserve funds, so the programs haven't been impacted during this current biennium. But without a change to statutes, the funding for these programs is going to drop off drastically in the next biennium. And if you refer to the sheet I gave you, it's a one-pager. It has some numbers on it, and it sort of compares ADM versus what we're calling slots or beds. You can see that if you calculate the payments based on ADM, and you lose about $8.5 million in the biennium. So what we're trying to do essentially is get permission from the legislature to continue drawing down these funds as we have been for the last 15 years, because these programs have built their budgets over the last decade and a half based on these expectations of funding. So a couple other comments I'd like to make about ADM and why we don't think that works is because the ADM is an average and assumes that the student population is relatively stable over the course of time. And many of these kids come in and out of these programs, but we have to have the services available and ready for them when they are injured or do have a mental issue. So some kids we certainly have kids that are served 365 days a year that are in these facilities being treated for their mental or physical illness 365 days a year, but we also have students that might just be in there for a week or two or 3 weeks while they recover from surgery or some sort of injury. So essentially what we have to do is we have to make sure that there's staff, that there's teachers available, and the educational resources available for these kids when they do come in here. And I want to make a distinction that we are, the department, what we're not paying for the medical services or the mental services that these students are getting. So we're not paying for the hospital fees and things like that. This is strictly money to pay for their education, and that was a question that came up in the Senate that we wanted to to make sure we get clarified over here. So just to kind of, and these are just sort of numbers for an example, but if the agencies that we deal with, Department of Human Services, Youth Authority, expect that the capacity for a program in any given region, say it's 15 students, then we need to make sure that their staff, materials, supplies, and equipment ready at all times to provide services to those 15 students, because one day that facility may have 5 students, but a week later they might have 15 students. And so we need to have those resources available at all times. So what we want to do with Senate Bill 70, the first thing it does, it ensures that the hospitals and the long-term care programs and our ESDs and school districts that provide these services continue to receive funding that's consistent with their historical funding. So I want to make this very clear. We're not asking for an increase in funding. We're not asking for more funding. We're asking that we be allowed to draw down money from the state school fund as we always have, and as we, frankly, have been doing incorrectly for at least 15 years, according to our staff, who sort of looked into that procedure.
So can I seek a clarification mm-hmm. right there? So this does not change anything about the way the money goes now. It just says, okay, you can keep doing what you have been.
That is correct.
Doing. No money moves from one place to another.
I think the one caveat I would put on that is we are drawing it down correctly during the current school year. So in this buying in for the first year, we did it the way we always had. For this current school year, we're doing it correctly and making up the lost revenue with other sources in reserve that we have for these programs. So they haven't felt an impact this year. If we don't change it, mm-hmm. they will feel that during the next school year.
So where will the impact come from in shifting the... So if you drew down correctly this time, there was less that came in. Where did the other, it looks like, $6 million go?
I'm sure. So, and I might have to ask Steve to help me with this, but if I'm understanding your question correctly, we did draw down on ADM this school year, and then we had reserve funds and other IDEA funds, I believe, that we used to fill the lost funds that we weren't able to draw down off the state school fund.
Right. I understand that part. Okay. I'm just looking at the 08-09 transfer. I just gave you the wrong number, but the transfer amount using slots out of the state school fund was $8.9 million, and the transfer amount using ADM was $5.8
million. Mm-hmm.
The difference is the $3.1 million. If you didn't draw that whole amount down, where did that $3.1 million go in this biennium?
Oh, it went out to school districts in the form of payments in their state school fund. So they're just a few extra dollars for every kid.
Okay.
So.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question. So the other thing is, you know, essentially the other point we want to make, that the bill is essentially revenue neutral because, again, we're not asking for an increase per pupil. We're not asking for an increase in funding, but we're asking to prevent a drastic drop-off in funding that we won't have reserves or other funds to make up for during the next biennium. So if this change is not made, we're very concerned that all of our providers and our contractors will not be able to provide these services and may not even be willing to do that at these significantly reduced levels. I've talked to representatives from COSA, OSBA, OEA, OSEA, and others. They all support the bill and sort of understand why it's necessary for the next biennium. We don't know anyone that opposes this change, and so we'd ask you, we have a little technical change with the -3 amendment where we actually need to use the terminology slots rather than students to reflect that we don't want to draw down from the actual number of students. We want to draw down from the actual number of slots or placements that are available. If you do it by students, you know, we have roughly, I think it's, you know, 3,500 hospital and LTCT slots that serve well more than probably 10,000 kids a biennium. So we don't want to draw down 10,000 shares of state school fund because these kids go in and out. We just want to draw down by the number of beds that are available. So With that, we'd be happy to answer any questions, and I'm guessing there's going to be some.
So is that what prevents the double witting of the kid? So if you've got a kid in the Gresham-Barlow School District, and they become injured, and they're recovering at Shriners. Mm-hmm. So now they're funded through that Shriners slot. Does Gresham-Barlow continue to receive? They continue to receive their reimbursement for that student. So say he gets injured in October. He's at Shriners for 6 weeks. What happens to the school district that serves him? And then secondly, on the same question the other day, once the students go into the school, who is responsible for them?
I'll let Steve take a shot at that.
Representative Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Smith with the Oregon Department of Education. In answer to your question, if a student is injured or experiences an illness and is housed at one of the hospital programs, the district where the student's parents resides would not report that student on ADM and receive any funding for that student during the time that they are at the hospital. The hospital program would report the student on ADM, and the funding for that that student for that period of time would come through the department out to our contractors, which are in the hospital programs that are ESDs, would go to the ESD through our contract, and that student's education would be paid for that way. And then when the student is ready to return to the home school, the hospital program would work with the home school district to make sure that the transition happened. And as soon as the student began attending in Gresham-Barlow, in your example, then Gresham-Barlow would begin receiving the state school funds through ADM.
And again, this goes back to the question we had on Monday. The money piece makes sense, but what about the student? Who is the student's principal when they're at the hospital? Who does the parent call if there's a problem with the educational program when they're at the hospital? Who is ultimately responsible if the parents file a due process complaint? Is it the hospital? Is it the Department of Education? Is it the school district? How does the family get accountability, and who does the student turn to if they have questions? Not the student's money, not the amount of money that goes with the kid. Where does the kid live educationally when the kid is in what temporarily in one of these locations?
Representative Gelser, I think the answer to that question is they live at the hospital program, so the hospital program is responsible and for the education of that student, and if there's any questions about the education, it would be the hospital program, the education program administrator at the hospital that would be the first point of contact. And
so if I was a parent and my IEP wasn't being followed and I went to due process, the litigation would be against the hospital?
It would be against the education provider at the hospital program.
It would not be the hospital.
And Jared Gelser, we
not
actually,
the hospital itself,
you know, when this question came up on Monday, we actually have a meeting at ODE tomorrow to sort of try to get the answers to those questions. We've got Cindy Hunt and Ty Maneri, who you met the other day, who's our special ed legal expert. And these are questions that, frankly, I don't think we've ever been asked before, and we just want to make sure we get proper answers to those. But we do have a meeting tomorrow to sort of clarify that.
And to be clear, I'll hold this bill and the other bill until we get those questions worked out. But I think my intent would be, and I don't know where the rest of the committee is, the money is important. It's how we pay for things. But the reason that we're here is to serve the students. And what I want to make sure is that there's always that clear line of somebody is accountable for the student. The student knows where they belong, and that, I mean, ultimately, it would be my hope that they're always the responsibility of that home school district, because the hope would be they would go back to that local school district. Representative Norman.
Chair Gelser, but what happens is that it goes through the ESD, and that muddies up the issue, because now you've got a kid who's been paid, the school district's been paid for this child. Now this child is in a different situation, so now the ESD is paid to provide the education. Is that clear? Okay. So that's, to me, there's got to be a better way to do this, because it's extremely complicated, and I'm not sure.
And I think it's two pieces. I think the funding stream and how does the money go, and maybe it's a place where the school district manages that ADM and they have the contract, and it follows that way. But even if a kid's in a local school district, they may be receiving services from the ESD in that local district, but ultimately it's the responsibility of that local school district to meet FAPE for that, a free and appropriate public education for that student. If the ESD falls down on its responsibilities, the local school district is still responsible for that. And the idea being every kid has a place, has an educational home that's responsible for them. And I'm worried that these students are transient and basically homeless. There's nobody that's claiming them. Who's test when they do their standardized testing? What cohort do they fall into? Where does it get reported out? Where does their school outcome data in terms of diplomas and modified diplomas, does that get reported to the ESD? Is that connected to the local school district? Is that connected to the hospital? It just seems like the kid has to be what's important.
And I think Chair Gelser, and again, we're going to try to clarify this, but and I may live to eat these words, but my limited understanding is that still the responsibility or the they are still residents of the school districts from where they come from. And the school districts, you know, we have this mechanism to provide the educational services while they're recovering from their illness, but ultimately they are still residents of the school district that they come from, and my suspicion is that all their test scores and things like that count with the school district. But we, frankly, no one has ever asked this question before, I think in the way maybe you're asking it before, and I think people just need to get together and make sure. I know the answer is that there's not anybody responsible for them. So we just want to get some clarification, and we should have that by the end of the week for you.
And I look forward to that. My intention is to hold both this bill and the bill we heard the other day and not move either of them forward until we have an answer to that question and language that can move into one or both bills to make sure that there's accountability for the students. Representative Dembro.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Morgan and anyone. So students who are in this program, is there an average length of time? I mean, what kind of, I assume it's probably a broad range, right? But where do most of them fall in terms of how far they're away from their resident district?
Chair Gelser and Representative Dembro, I'll let Steve take a shot at this if we have some numbers off the top of it. But generally, I mean, they could be very short stay, a few days, a couple weeks. We do have kids that are in these facilities year-round, but I don't know if we have any averages.
Representative, or Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Dembro, we do have some data on for long-term care and treatment programs. It looks like...
Can you please identify yourself for the record again?
Sorry, Steve Smith with the Oregon Department of Education. Let me pull this out here. It looks like the days of length of stay for long-term care and treatment programs averages anywhere between 21 and 365 days, according to data that we collected last October. And then broken out by the bottom third of the programs, 21 to 122 days, the middle third, 130 to 240 days, and the top third, 270 to 365. We don't have data on length of stay in terms of hospital programs, but the hospital programs are much shorter in duration for the most part, and sometimes with both of the programs, kids will be there for a short time and then they'll go back to their home school district, and then on occasion they'll need to come back, especially in terms of hospital programs if they have repeated treatment needs, things like that. They'll go back and forth several times.
Madam Chair, just to follow up, and Steve, the difference in numbers between the hospital programs and the long term, I mean, are most of the students that we're talking about in the long term, or are they in the hospital program?
Representative Gelser, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Dembro, the majority of the students we're talking about are in the long term care and treatment programs. The number of slots for long term care and treatment programs is about 1,200 a year, and that's probably between 3,000 and 4,000 individual students. The number of students in the number of spaces in the hospital programs is about 300. I think it's 157 per year of the biennium, and so that translates into about 1,500 kids a year.
Thank you.
Are there further questions for this panel, Representative Roblin?
Mostly just a statement. I think the numbers are difficult because each of these is an individual and they vary so much. And having had a number of students over my years in the high school in both programs. When you asked the question, I started thinking about it and saying, there's no average here. Because we had a student that got leukemia and became very, very ill and ended up at Dornbecker going through treatments. And they would do treatments for a while, and when they got back to health, they'd come back to school for a while, and then they'd wait, and then they'd go back to Dornbecker for the treatments. And I would say that the school districts always felt they were their kids the whole time. So in answer to Representative Gelser's question, I think that answer will come out, because we had another student who ended up with a very, very rare disease that lasted his entire life. He is deceased now. But in his school years, he was the longest living in his particular deal. He had to go back to Washington, D.C. for treatments and then come back and in and out of Dornbecker's and then back to school. So individuals. And then there's people with debilitating diseases, cerebral palsy, and others who end up in a nursing home and others in this care in hospitals or long-term care. And they're there pretty much their whole time in school. I mean, they aren't really, we don't see them at the school building. And those kids are still considered the school district. I mean, so I'm surprised they didn't have that answer, because I certainly believe that from our perspective, in all the ones that I know of, the school district always sent people to IEPs. They were always involved in those, even though some of them were a long ways away in Portland. There was always a member, because the school district realize that that was part of their responsibility. So I think I expect that's the answer that's going to come back. I certainly think that's what our district felt the answer was.
What's interesting is that what's not on the list, and maybe I'm just looking over it, is the Providence Child Center up in Portland. And one of the reasons that got me thinking about this was when I worked at the Department of Human Services and I was working on why do kids live in nursing homes, what I learned about those students was that when they came, they became students of the Portland Public Schools, and some of them went out to Portland Public School during the day. For some of them, the services came in. But they, in terms of their developmental disability services, some of them stopped getting them altogether. In other places, there was an assumption that there was some courtesy case management. But in that center, they age out. And because there was nobody looking after them in terms of the system back in their local districts and their local communities, both on the human service and the education side, for that 18 to 21 and beyond 21 age group, it was impossible, nearly impossible, to find placement. So if these kids were going to move into group homes or foster care homes, nobody back in their communities knew them. And so the result of that ended up being a number of them just moved on to an adult nursing home facility, which is a really bad public policy choice before you even start considering it's just a really not a great choice for people with disabilities to put them in institutions. So I think these things all fit together when we have high-need kids that might move to a different physical location, but really needing to make sure they're rooted in a place. Because everyone grows up, children become adults, adults live in communities, when all of a sudden all these labels fall off, but we all need places to live, and school is part of the way we develop those networks. Representative Comp.
Thank you. Surprise, surprise, I have a fiscal question. Mr. Allen, you said that you drew down your cash reserves and IDEA funds. I'd appreciate if you could give us, not necessarily today, but how much money do you do have in cash reserves and IDEA funds? And also, if you if you're aware of if there's additional federal stimulus dollars in this area, it would be helpful to know about, too.
Chair Gelson, Representative Comp, we can do that. And the reserves that we did have from available to long-term care and treatment were from the long. We had kept reserves for long-term care and treatment in place for emergency situations. So that's what we were able to draw down from. But we can get you some numbers.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Comp.
Sure. Any further questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that wants to be heard on this bill? No? All right. Then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 70. And we've just hit the 1:30 mark.
And?
Well, we have someone coming at 1:30. So let's stand at ease for a minute and give her a call so that we don't start another bill. just to start it. So we'll be at ease for just a couple minutes. All right, we are back on the record. And I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 901A. Senator Bonamici. And Kevin, do you want to give a brief overview while Senator Bonamici is
headed? Very, very brief overview. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, this permits a school district that has not offered benefit plans provided by OWEB to provide or contract for benefit plans other than those provided by the board if the premiums for the benefit plan are equal or less than the premiums for a comparable plan. We had a similar bill to this, a House bill that tweaked some issues, and I'm completely zoning on the number right now, but Senator Bonamici can enlighten us on some of the details, further details. This does declare an emergency and is effective upon passage.
Thank you. Senator Bonamici, welcome.
Thank you very much, Representative Gelser and members of the committee. I'm Suzanne Bonamici. I represent Senate District 17, and I'm submitting this testimony in support of Senate Bill 901. And what I wanted to do with this bill is clarify and fulfill the legislative intent that was in Senate Bill 426, which some of you, but not all of you, supported in the 2007 session. And the goal was of that bill was really to bring down the cost of health insurance for school employees statewide by pooling and using the state's purchasing power. Some of the districts, at the time we were contemplating that bill, some of the districts and some of the legislators were very concerned because their districts, school districts in their legislative districts, had cost-effective plans, and they didn't want to give up those plans if joining the Oregon Educator Benefit Board would increase their costs or decrease the benefits. And so during that process, there were some modifications made to Senate Bill 426, and what those modifications said was that a district would only be required to join OEB if the benefits that OEB provided were comparable. And comparability meant that they didn't have to pay more or get less. Well, this year, colleagues, when I went to look at the statute, I found that the language that guaranteed comparability was actually when 426 was codified in the Oregon Revised Statutes. That language about comparability that said that a district didn't need to go in if they were going to pay more or get less, that was in a footnote. And the footnote had essentially expired. And so I was very concerned about that because there are still several districts that are not in OEB, either because they aren't at the time in their collective bargaining agreement that requires them to go into OEB, or they were granted waivers because OEB does have a rule saying if you don't have, if you can't get comparable benefits, you don't need to go in. So I contacted legislative counsel because I was very concerned about why was that language in a footnote when it was, for myself, and I know for many of my colleagues, the reason why we supported that bill. So the legislative council opinion, which my staff is photocopying at the moment and is on its way, it basically says that this bill is absolutely necessary to clarify that statute. And I'm sorry you don't have that yet. She's copying it and should be here in just a minute. So that's what Senate Bill 901 does. It clarifies that districts can remain out of OEB as long as their existing plan is better, according to a biennial actuarial review. It does not allow districts that are already in OEB to go out of OEB. It does allow districts that aren't in because of the timing of their collective bargaining agreement or because they were granted a waiver. It provides that statutory authority for them to stay out if they can't get comparable benefits by going in. We did include an additional provision in the bill. We started out with the district I was working with was concerned about having to do this comparability analysis every year. We put in a two-year provision so that they can request a comparability analysis every 2 years instead of every year. But we also put in that if the organization representing the employees wants to request comparability, that kind of analysis, they can do that as well. So if, say, for example, you had a district that said, well, we request a comparability. We're not going to do that for another 2 years. But the teachers say, well, wait, we think we might be able to get a better deal from OEB. So it allows them to just request that comparability analysis. It doesn't change the requirements at all. So by rule and by practice, OEB has allowed districts to whom they can't provide comparability to sort of opt out or stay out. And that, as I explained, is in a rule of OEB. But as you may have heard, a rule has to be supported by underlying legislation. So what Senate Bill 901 does is it really fulfills the legislative intent of the original Senate Bill 426 and allows districts that are not in OEB legislative clarity and certainty that if they can provide benefits on their own that are a better deal, they can continue to do that and not join OEB. So, Chair Gelser and committee, I urge you to send Senate Bill 901 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much.
It looks like the opinion arrived while it's speaking.
The opinion has arrived. And thank you for your careful study of the issue and catching something that really needed to be caught.
You're welcome.
Are there questions for Senator Bonamici? Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I have several.
I have time.
Thank you. And I want to thank the Senator for her work on this issue. We sat together on the floor in 2007 and had a couple conversations about this bill, which I vehemently opposed and still don't believe that districts should be forced into a plan that costs more than they can purchase outside of the plan. And so my questions are, number one, in the Senator, I apologize if you can't answer the question. I'm not trying to put you on the spot here. But in the fiscal analysis, it says that this bill applies to 10 school districts. I'm assuming that the 10 school districts that are listed are school districts that received waivers.
There is, Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, they either received waivers or they are not at the time in their collective bargaining agreement where they would be required to go into OM.
Okay, and that is as of when? Because Grants Pass School District number 7 is self-insured, not in OEB, and not on the list. So there are, I believe, some other districts that are self-insured.
Chair Gelser and Representative Maurer. There's a separate section of the bill that deals with the districts that had a trust, an insurance trust, and that's a separate part of the statute. It's a very convoluted statute, Chair
very
Gelser
convoluted.
And Representative Maurer. This particular section was intended to deal with the districts that were either given waivers or were not at the point of time of their collective bargaining agreement. There's another part of the statute that deals with the districts that had a trust.
Okay.
That would be my understanding of why that particular district would not be on the list.
Okay.
So why am I know that Corvallis School District, which I represent, has a waiver. They applied for that waiver, and this has just been recently. Is there a reason why they wouldn't be on the list? They were not self-insured.
Chair Gelser, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I apologize. I didn't study the districts and don't know which districts have been given waivers. I know Bethel has been given a waiver and a couple of others, so I don't know why they aren't on the list. But Chair Gelser and Representative Maurer, if you'd like, I can follow up with Legislative Fiscal and find out why those aren't on the list.
No, actually, that isn't as important. The next question, I just want to make sure that the actuarial analysis is going to be conducted by OEB?
Chair Gelser and Representative Maurer, that is correct. We originally had proposed that it be an independent actuary, and that we weren't able to move that bill forward.
Okay. And
for various reasons.
Well, I think that this, thank you, the smaller districts would just be, I mean, sorry out of luck, because they couldn't afford an actuarial every year. And quite frankly, if someone wanted a MIM, all they do is say, I want it every year, and you're shelling out a pretty big chunk. Now, a school district like Beaverton, a very large school district, quite frankly, could afford an annual analysis, but an example like a Bethel school district would struggle.
Right. And Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer, the actuarial analysis is provided by OEB.
Okay.
Representative Maurer has been trying to get me to pay for various things of his for a while, and now he's after my school district to pay for something for his humor.
No, I
what are we, Representative Parker, a third of the committee?
Ow. Chair Gelser, Representative Parker, thank you. I appreciate the humor. It's district in my district, too.
Well, and to follow on, that district was really the center of our conversation in 07 about this.
Correct.
Because they had, you know, significant concerns, and so it's not that they are in my district, but they are kind of a watch district, you know, one that, because they're pretty aggressive, they manage their district pretty aggressively, and so if any district is up on it, they are. What I don't want to do is I don't want this. I'm not quite sure exactly what this does for these districts. I mean, really, why? Is it? It's a purely clarification.
Chair Gelser and Representative.
Because the bill is nebulous. I mean, there's a lot of ambiguity in the bill. The language is not very clear. So this is purely clarification?
Chair Gelser and Representative Maurer, the concern that brought me to bring this bill forward at the state that it's in now is that there was no statutory provision, effective statutory provision, that allowed that comparability waiver. there was a rule, but as you may have heard in the legislature, right. You can't have a rule without the underlying statutory authority. And so this clarifies that to allow the districts who can get comparable benefits without going into OEB. If they are getting a better price on their own, then they can continue to apply for those waivers.
Any further questions before we move on?
No, I yield my time.
You yield your time. Representative Van Orman, Representative Maurer yields his time to you.
Thank you, Representative Maurer. Thank you, Chair Gelser. This is not necessarily about the merits of this bill, because I understand what you're trying to do, but one of the questions I have, and it's probably for the experienced people on this committee, is where is the tipping point of when, if we continue with waivers, that the intent of creating OEB to help districts in their purchasing of health care benefits, when does it defeat the purpose? Where's that tipping point? Do we have any idea? Will we ever know?
Well, Chair Gelser and Representative Van Ornum, the testimony that we had in the Senate Education Committee from OEB indicated that all of the districts that are currently in OEB are saving money. And it's at the point now where there's so many districts, and it's my understanding that several community colleges joined OEB without the requirement to join OEB because they found it financially beneficial to join. So from the testimony, and you may have people from OEB here, I don't know, but the testimony that we heard in the Senate is that they are at the point where OEB is at the point where they are seeing cost savings. And because this bill does not allow districts to leave, this bill wouldn't affect that particular issue. There may be other economic factors that affect the ongoing strength of an insurance pool that I certainly am not qualified to talk about, but this bill only applies to the districts that are not currently in OEB.
Thank you.
And most of them are.
Thank you, Suzanne.
You're welcome, Chair Gelser and Suzanne.
Senator Bonamici, can ask a question really quick. Would it be fair to say that what this bill does, if you opposed the bill or you supported the bill in 2007, it doesn't address any of the reasons why you may have supported or opposed it? This simply allows what the stated intent of the bill was to carry forward?
Chair Gelser, you could certainly say that, although there may be others who disagree with that. My purpose in supporting it, I supported the bill in 2007 because it permitted districts that could get a better deal on their insurance from having to go into OEB. That was what led me to support OEB, because I saw the benefits of a purchasing pool, but not for the districts that could get a better rate on their insurance outside of the pool. So that's why I supported it. But when I realized that language was no longer in the statute, I thought it was best to clarify that so that the full intent of the statute was carried forward rather than ended by the disappearance of the footnote that included that language. So it clarifies that districts who can't get comparable benefits in OEB do not have to go into OEB.
Thank you very much. Representative Maurer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure all districts have saved money. I think Corvallis may be Corvallis is in a conundrum where part of the collective, there's two units.
Right, there's three units.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Two are in, one is out, and it was because of the way their collective bargaining agreements turned over that they went in. They're paying less on the group that's out, but because their other two units are in, they can't come back out, and that's frustrating to the school district because they can see in their third group that they're saving money, and they assume that if they had those other two out, they would save more money, and they would then be able to hire more teachers.
And so a follow-up to that, that's my problem. If OEB is a good deal, then districts are going to go in. And if it's not a good deal, why do you hold a statutory gun to their head and say you can't go out? Because you generally, this is saying you can shop in Walmart, but once you walk in the door, you're ours. You can never go to Fred Meyer And this is, when you're an OLEB, you're done. That's it. And now, what do you dissolve as a district and then reform as another district, and now you can start over? Maybe that's the way out.
And I don't think this bill changes that. What this bill does do is protect school districts like mine who are currently out to be able to stay out for the portions where they can demonstrate that. And for that reason, not just because of Corvallis, but for Beaverton and other districts as well, I think it's important that we preserve that mechanism that we thought we agreed to last time to allow them to stay out if they can get a better deal elsewhere.
Yeah. And my analogy was actually backwards. You walk into Neiman Marcus and they say, you can't leave, even though you can only afford Walmart. That'd be a better analogy. So revise and extend my remarks, Madam Chair.
Chair Gelser, the House Education Committee has both analogies and humor, unlike the humorless. I'm enjoying it here. So Chair Gelser, I don't want to speculate on why if some of the bargaining units of Corvallis are in OEB and they're paying more, why they weren't given a waiver. I don't know, but perhaps that's something that OEB can answer for you.
And we're working with. I think the point was just that you might have districts that are split, and it goes to this point that you're not going to. It creates a problem if people are jumping in and people are jumping out. If you look at the district I represent in this bill, what this does, it does not allow them to pull out the groups that are in, but it allows them to keep the group that is out.
And also, that's correct.
Are there any further, Representative Comp?
Just a comment, Chair. Thank you, Senator Bonamici, because I appreciate the clarification that it does get placed in statute so that these districts do have this ongoing protection if they can make these cost savings. But as we were, as testimony here earlier on the cost savings overall in 1 year to schools is $38 million. That's $38 million in the state school fund that then gets redistributed throughout schools.
Yep. Better for kids.
Madam Chair, an example in Three Rivers, who is on this list of 10, that the cost of staying out, actually, because they were going to get pulled in and then at the last minute got reprieved, but that cost was not going to be absorbed by the state school fund. That was going to be absorbed by each individual employee. So the people that this ostensibly is supposed to help were going to pay the bill because they had come to an agreement through collective bargaining to cap, which most districts quite have a cap.
Chair, I do stand corrected, it did not go to the state school fund, but the individual districts may well be the way I'm unclear about how that cost saving is impacted throughout the state.
Yeah, and clearly, I'm sorry, but clearly there are community colleges that, and some school districts made huge gains. You know, good for them.
And I think it's a matter of all of our school districts are different, and there are some that did very well.
Exactly.
I think it is truly the minority of districts that haven't done well under this plan that aren't saving money, and what this is trying to do is for those for whom that wasn't the case but aren't already in, we're going to allow them to do it in the way that's most cost-effective to them.
And also, it's consistent with what OEB has said their policy is and what their rule is. I believe that for the districts, it's important to have that in statute so it's confirmed and they can rely on it.
Well, this has been a good discussion, but we have four more bills on the agenda today. Is there anything else to be said on this bill? No?
Thank you very much.
I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 901A and opening a work session on Senate Bill 901A. Representative Dembro.
Madam Chair, I move that we send Senate Bill 901A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dembro moves Senate Bill 901A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, I will be supporting this bill because it does add clarification, but the support for the bill doesn't mean support for the original.
Duly noted. Any further discussion?
Yeah.
Representative Parker.
Thank you. What's the relationship between this bill and the House bill that we have passed much the same? I didn't realize you were going to try to move this bill.
Oh, sorry.
I apologize.
This bill, the difference between this bill and the other bill is that we moved the other bill to rules, and this bill would be going to the floor. So this bill would become law. I think that the other difference is the other one had some more, and there were so many of them that we heard. I have them all a little confused in my mind, but I can follow up with you later. I believe the other bill would have provided more flexibility. The other bill is in rules.
It's a euphemism.
Is that the one you wanted? It's too late now.
Is there any further discussion?
No.
Seeing none, Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Rutgers?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Representative Kopp?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Excused.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Van Orman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Denbrough?
Aye.
Chair Gelser?
Aye. The motion passes and the bill goes to the floor. I will carry this bill on the floor, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 901A. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 72A.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, before you is 72A. It removes ESDs from the definition of a school district under general provisions of special education service statutes. It also permits a parent of a child with a disability to revoke in writing consent for an initial evaluation, reevaluation, or provisions of special education-related service or placement program. This does declare an emergency and is effective upon passage. There are no amendments with respect to that.
Welcome.
Thank
back.
You, Chair Gelser, and for members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and joining me is Ty Maneri, our legal specialist in the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships. We're here today to ask for your support for Senate Bill 72, which is, unfortunately, Representative Maurer, another technical cleanup bill to bring Oregon statute in line with federal law and regulations related to special education. And the bill really does two things. The first thing it does is it is a technical update to statute to clarify that school districts and not ESDs are responsible for meeting the special education needs of students in their school districts. It doesn't impact the school district's ability to contract with an ESD to provide these services. But unfortunately, in several places in Oregon statute, there's still language that defines a school district for special education services, and ESDs are still included in that definition, and they shouldn't be. Under federal law, school districts are the ones that are responsible for providing special education services. If they choose to do that through contracting with their ESD, that's okay. But an ESD can't sort of be responsible for those students. It's the school district. So the bill addresses that. That's the first part. So it clarifies those special education and services are ultimately responsible from the school district. And then the second part, and this was an amendment we added in the Senate, which is why there's an engrossed version of it. On December 31st, 2008, the outgoing presidential administration made some changes to IDEA. The major change to IDEA, that's the Federal Individual with Disabilities Education Act, the major change was that it allowed parents to unilaterally remove students from special education programs and services. Under the previous IDEA regulations, students could only exit special education services by aging out, graduating, or getting a new evaluation that determined they would no longer be eligible for special education services. So the language in the engrossed bill reflects that change in the federal IDEA regulations. As the committee probably knows, federal IDEA law trumps state special education law, and in order to continue receiving IDEA funds, we have to assure the U.S. Department of Education that our statutes meet their regulations. So there are a couple other little technical things there. They're included in my testimony. An example, there's some old language in IDEA that talked about pre-placement evaluation and just terminology change where things like that get changed to initial evaluation. There's a couple other things in there that reflect some of those last-minute changes to IDEA. So the short version of that is if we want to make sure that Oregon complies with federal special education law, we need to pass Senate Bill 72, and we will be happy to answer any questions and urge your support.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Morgan? Any discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative
Morgan, when did you write this?
This testimony?
Yes.
I believe I wrote this testimony, well, I updated it today, but I originally wrote it probably a month ago or so when it was in the Senate. There must be a typo in there you caught.
No, Madam Chair.
It doesn't say Chair Hastert.
It's a word choice in here that you used. It said you would be happy to answer any questions. So if you wrote it a month ago, you preordained it. But since you updated this morning, I'll give you.
Thank you. I'm always happy to answer the committee's questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I think this is an important bill to pass. I don't like that the leading administration made changes to what is essentially a civil rights law on their way out the door, and I have significant concerns about unilateral removal from special education, which is something that could be abused and parents could be manipulated to unilaterally remove their students, and that troubles me deeply. But we do need the money. But I'm going to vote no. Debbie, would you please call the roll?
No, we haven't.
We don't have a motion. Sorry.
Did you just say you're going to vote no?
I would like to register my protest of unilateral. I mean, we have to pass the bill because we need the special education money. But you can't have. This is a very, very complicated federal law, and to have an administration change it without input in ways that are actually harmful to students, I realize we are a state legislature, that we cannot change what the federal government has done. That was a change that will harm students. We are required to do it in order to continue to get federal money in order to support students, but it frustrates me greatly to continue to see the special education law chipped away at. Although I ended that with a preposition.
You did.
That's
all right.
Mrs. Lehman from my ninth grade English class would be very unhappy right now. Is there any further discussion? Close the public hearing on. Pardon? Did you have anything to add? All right. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on this bill? Sorry, in my excitement about this, I'm just breaking all the rules. I apologize. Can I close the public hearing now?
Yeah, please. Move on.
I would close the public hearing on Senate Bill 72A. Is there a work session on Senate Bill 72A?
Madam Chair, I move that we send Senate Bill 72A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dimbro moves Senate Bill 72A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Nope. Debbie, would you please call the roll?
Representative Harper?
Aye.
Representative Heflin?
Aye.
Representative Tom?
Aye.
Representative Miller?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Excuse.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative
Van
Lorman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dimbro?
Aye.
Chair Gilbert?
No, thank you.
Having received the required votes, the bill is declared passed and moves to the floor. Who would like to carry this bill?
I'll carry it.
Representative Kopp will carry the bill.
I'd love to debate with you on the floor.
I'll be tough. All right. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 72A. Did I see Senator Metzger come back in?
Yes, I'm just waiting.
You're waiting on 118, right?
Yes.
I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 118.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, before you is Senate Bill 118 authorizes the State Board of Higher Education delegate broad powers, duties, or functions to the Chancellor of the Oregon University System, President or State Institution of Higher Education other than functions other than prescribing enrollment fees. There is an amendment that has been provided that does some substantial clarification to the bill itself. The amendment provides that the State Board of Higher Education may delegate powers or functions granted to the board by some specified statutes rather than kind of the broad overlay to the Chancellor of the Oregon University System or State Institution of Higher Education within the Oregon University System. Senator Metzger is here to speak. Also, we do have the fiscal and revenue with respect to the amendments as well. So.
Great. Thank you very much. Senator Metzger.
I'm going to speak in opposition, so it probably might be better for the proponents to make
your case.
Okay. I appreciate it.
Great. So I'm looking. So Tony Van Vliet, George Prinsteiner, please. These are opposed. Welcome.
Welcome.
It's good to see you.
Good to see you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tony Van Vliet. I'm Vice Chair of the State Board of Higher Education, and I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 118 today. Having sat where you're sitting for 20 years and 11 special sessions, and 17 of them on Ways and Means, I thoroughly sympathize what you're going through this session and on the budget matters. Senate Bill 118 really is a culmination of what has been coming to a lot of the board members over several years, and that is our ability basically to use our board meetings to deal with large policy issues and not a lot of the smaller mundane issues that come along. And some of those, we have reorganized ourselves into three committees, not too dissimilar to what the legislature does in listening to particular areas of concern. And it does allow for more public input. We have three committees. Those are governance, strategic planning, and finance. And they have five members on each of them. And the intent of this particular bill is really summed in Section 2 of the original bill that came over to you from the Senate. And that allows us basically to give the Chancellor the opportunity to send particular kinds of issues down to the various committees, and then as those things come back to the full board, if they're basically policy decisions, that is really where we want to be as we spend our time on that board. And when there's smaller decisions, such as whether you're going to issue a contract for soft drinks at an institution, those kind of things can really be handled at a different level within the state system. And so this is what this particular bill is about. Section 2 is really the main part. The rest of it is somewhat boilerplate. There is some concern. I don't personally understand what some of the concerns are about it from students or from the labor unions, except they may feel that somehow the powers are going to be so diluted down the chain of command that they wouldn't have any inputs or say-so. But that's, if any of you have attended a State Board of Higher Education meeting, that is the last thing that occurs at our meetings. We spend a lot of time listening to public testimony, and we pay particular attention to students and to union concerns. But we would like to be able to deal with more public input, which the committee system would allow us to do. We're basically at a crossroads in higher ed. There is no doubt you know that looking at 25% to 30% budget cuts, we're at a stage now which is really a crisis. And I'm sure you know how serious this is, because come your next budget time, you're going to see exactly how bad it is. And the roller coaster ride that we've been on since 1990 is getting sort of tough to really cope with at state board level. And one of the things that we're dealing with is basically we have people that want to start splitting the system up, throw members out, close institutions, anything that would really be in the worst possible thing for the people of the state of Oregon. It is really our obligation to educate and create a smooth transition from high school and community colleges into higher ed. We've made great leaps and bounds in the last 5 years in that with our joint board efforts. So this will give us a little bit more flexibility to look for some economies that are real economies that can be made, give us a little bit more flexibility and footwork, and allow the Chancellor to really, so we can delve into this crisis situation, which right now I can tell you it has a lot of the board members quite frustrated in how we're going to deal with it. So I'll turn it over to the Chancellor, who will tell you some of the things that are worries to him about this particular, about the amendments to this particular bill, that where it would put us, and you can speak to that.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, George Bernsteiner with the Oregon University System. Thank you for the opportunity I have not enjoyed before in 20 years of testifying in this body. I have never before come before a legislative committee and asked you to support a bill and oppose proposed amendments to it. So this is I'm not quite sure how to do this, so I'm going to try.
I'm urging you to support A. Engrossed Senate Bill 118 for the reasons that Tony Van Vliet just laid out to you. The board a year and a half ago adopted a strategic plan for the state system, a plan which had four basic tenets. One is to raise the education level of adult Oregonians in order that Oregon and its citizens are successful and competitive in the 21st century. The second is to provide affordable access to quality education in order to help achieve that first goal. The third is to spur innovation in a way that will help the economy of the state of Oregon. And the fourth is to provide economic and community development in all parts of the state. Those are the things our board intends to focus on. Those are the things about which they hold the presidents and me accountable. But in order to do that, the board, in order to focus on those things, wishes to be able to delegate certain others of its responsibilities to me or to the presidents. Under the Dash 5 amendments, let me suggest to you the things that the board either cannot delegate or might not be able to delegate because of the amendments. And I think you'll kind of understand that some of these things are important, and they are policy matters, and they are things that the board properly could or should consider. And in fact, in the last version, in the Engrossed version, some of those explicitly were called out that the board would not delegate. Tuition setting was the one that was noted in the Engrossed version. And in fact, that is something that the board has opted to maintain unto itself. Admission standards, conferring of degrees, the purchase, acceptance, sale, and lease of real estate, regardless of value. Those things, arguably, the board could spend time on, and I would understand a reasonable policy discussion about whether or not those should be delegated or under what considerations they might be delegated. But there are other things that are in statute that now become questionable as to whether or not the board could delegate them. For example, the board is responsible under statute for designating the class times at which classes are offered for part-time students. The board is responsible under the current statute for the recruitment of minority faculty. Not of any other faculty, only of minority faculty. Can that be delegated? We have questions now from legal counsel that raise the question, if you have a bill that specifically begins to say you can only delegate certain things and not others, that the things that are not specified for delegation may not be able to be delegated. So the recruitment of minority faculty may in fact become, perforce, a board responsibility. All contracts with other state agencies, other states, other universities, all other outside entities. Compliance with prevailing wage requirements from the Bureau of Labor and Industries would become a board function. Control and supervision of all data processing equipment used for accounting. This is an important one because this is the way we used to operate. About 15 years ago, we delegated to the larger campuses this responsibility. Would this, in fact, now render that delegation inoperative? Establishing the pay rate for each of our 12,000 employees, approving each payroll before it is paid, all advertisements and all publicity would be done by the board or by me. I got thinking about that, and you know, the Civil War game would be an interesting advertisement if all the advertisements had to come from the Chancellor's office. Selling of forest products, which historically has been done by the College of Forestry. I guess what I'm saying is, as we look at these Dash 5 amendments, they take away some of the things which historically the board has delegated, either because they had authority to do so or arguably did, and render us in a situation that actually would make it more difficult for the board to concentrate on policy issues than even is the case today. So coming back around, I would urge you to give the board the authority to focus on policy issues by allowing it to delegate administrative and other functions to me or to the presidents, and further, that you not adopt the amendments which would restrict them from doing so.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Tony. I appreciate that. You kicked that chair on the way in, did it? Madam Chair, members of the committee, Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. First of all, I want to thank the Chancellor and Mr. Van Vliet for their presentation of the bill. And we heard this, of course, in Senate Education. And I just want to draw a couple of comparisons here and what this action, in my view, does. I do not disagree at all with the intent of the bill. That's the first thing. Obviously, and I think many of you, as I, have served on boards. I've served on a very large financial institution board and others. And your job is not to do the minutiae of management, and that is absolutely true. However, a board often takes action that is brought by the management, and you may take a vote, but you don't get involved in all the minutiae of it, but you're ultimately responsible. And so a lot of that, I think, is in terms of how much minutiae you deal with is really kind of up to the board leadership of how they want to handle that. But what Senate Bill 118 does, I think, sends a very bad message to the public. And it says we have a higher education board, which is confirmed by the Senate, which is responsible to the citizens of Oregon, and we're making a very blanket statement that any and all powers can be delegated down the line to an employee, the president, or the chancellor. And not only, I think some of the points, that, and you may hear them in this testimony, I'm not sure or not, but I was alluded to in the opening remarks, in terms of where that chain of command and that ability to have redress on issues once it is delegated down the line to a point where you feel you cannot actively participate in its change. The second point is that while we always assume, and I think rightfully so, that the people who are running our universities or our chancellor or whoever that may be at the time and the components, members of the Board of Education at any time would exercise good fiduciary duty, not delegate things that are not proper to delegate, the fact that the legislature gives this broad authority, I believe, is not a responsible thing for this legislature to do. And I do believe that if the board wants to manage the day-to-day operations better, they can do that through the direction to management as to the work that is done in that area for them to take an action on if necessary. It does not require them to get involved with that. But I'll point out just a couple of things to you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. On page 2 of the Engross bill, what are some of these powers that potentially could be done? Acquire, receive, hold, convey, sell, manage, lease, lend, invest, improve and develop any and all real or personal property. There are some substantial areas here, and as the Chancellor pointed out, I don't think, and certainly this Chancellor was going to delegate those type of authorities to anyone else, but the fact of the matter is we're providing that authority in this bill. We're saying there are day-to-day problems in that the board doesn't need to manage, but we are also saying we can't identify those in particular that we would like to carve out legislatively, so we're just saying let us delegate all the authority in which we are responsible to those who do not have elected or appointed responsibility from this legislature. I'll leave you just with one example. This is the worst case scenario, but I mentioned it in the Senate a few weeks ago. I went to Lewis and Clark College, and I was appalled to read about 5 years ago, and some of you may, where our president, who was given the authority to invest with land and gifts to my great college, thought he has a real can't miss deal in Idaho. And if you ever read about that, it lost my college tens of millions of dollars because there was no board oversight. So was the board responsible? Yes, because they were the board, but it was like, I apologize. I mean, that was the extent of what they could do. So, yes, the president is now gone. Yes, some of the board members had to resign, but it didn't change the fact that there was no oversight until the horse had already left the barn. And I just believe that to send a message that we have a Board of Education, but we will allow them to convey any power, that if someday in the future, I don't want to be a former member of this legislature reading that as a result of action, this 2009 legislature, this happened. So I will conclude my testimony.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Senator Metzger? Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. When you delegate authority, does not relieve you of responsibility.
That's correct.
And so the board is, if they delegate the authority to the president of the university, I would think that's where they would need the delegation, but they wouldn't delegate it to a professor. They're just within a department or a college. They're going to, I mean, that's where that delegation goes. But it does not, if it's a board responsibility, the board is still responsible for that action. So in that delegation, they can, for example, the delegation of leasing property or purchasing real property, if they could put a sideboard on that delegation. That if you're going to purchase real property, you need to get over.
Representative Maurer, yes, that could be what they do. This bill does not require them to do that. And again, you mentioned the responsibility. You're right, they're responsible. But the fact of the matter is, if they've engaged in a contract because they were delegated that authority, you're not going to change the contract. So, you know, the responsibility would be they have to apologize, or maybe they're removed from the board, but the action has been taken. They have taken a legal action in some cases. Could happen. And yes, could they put sideboards on that? If that was the intent, why can't you draft legislation that says within these sideboards they may delegate? It just says it's just let them delegate anything and worry about the consequences later and worry about the apologies later.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. I have two questions, and it may require either you or the former respondents. One is, does the Sarbanes-Oxley federal legislation cover the university systems? So you fall under Sarbanes-Oxley?
The
public. Oh, good. Okay.
Chancellor, would you come back to the table so we can
yes,
have
thank
this officially
you.
On the record, and please reintroduce yourself.
For the record, George Pernsteiner of the Oregon University System. For purpose, Chair Gelser, Representative Van Orman, for purposes of Sarbanes-Oxley, there are provisions that deal specifically with private corporations. There is subsequent legislation that deals also with public organizations, and we are subject to the requirements of public organizations. Furthermore, under the Government Accounting Standards Board, there are requirements that are laid out, and we are subject to all of those.
Okay. And then the second follow-up. Are there other systems like what you're proposing in this country, like, let's say, the University of Wisconsin? Does their system work like that, or California, or do we know of other systems?
Chair Gelser, Representative Van Orman, this is not an uncommon model. I mean, in many states, there are universities are actually constitutional corporations and have that authority. In others, they have broad authority that is provided by the regions then to the president or the chancellors or whatever the titles happen to be in that state. I'm most familiar with the University of California, having been there, and
okay.
There's a considerable degree of authority granted to the president of the university and a lesser degrees of authority to the chancellors of the individual campuses.
Okay. Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, this is sort of a follow-up to first part of the question, which was asked by Representative Van Orman, but carved out of these changes is the ability to set tuition. And in these other states, is this the same pattern as is used elsewhere? Because we're right now wrestling with the setting of tuition, how much it's going to increase over time, annual increases in light of the budget consequence that we're going through right now. Do we differ there?
Chair Gelser, Representative Harker, most states each state has a somewhat different approach to tuition setting. But if I were to generalize, which is always a very dangerous thing to do, those which have systems typically keep at the system level
decisions about tuition, even if they have variable tuition among the campuses. And that's in order to affect statewide goals. And so this is what we have proposed in the Angros version is similar to that. So if you go to California, for example, which has a system, in fact, it's done by the president and the regents, not by the individual chancellors.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Metzger, are you the one that's responsible? Just maybe I missed it in your testimony. Are you the responsible party for the -A5 amendment?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I'm speaking only on the Angros bill.
Okay, I want to make sure those weren't the sideboards that you were referring to.
But so. I would want to just respond to the dialogue here that Representative Harker had. And I think you'll have Representative Oregon Student Association will be testifying on this bill. The tuition fees was their amendment on the Senate side to put it in. And I just draw attention to that and that was placed in, and I think you will hear from them that they felt that if that were to possibly be delegated, it would remove their ability to protest to the board whatever actions might be happening as it moves down a chain of command in which they don't have access. And my only point would be, if you saw that issue, because the OSA has a voice in this building, and so, wow, we carved that out. Think of all the other individuals who have a voice in some of the actions of the board who don't have voices here who can't have those carve-outs. And I also would commend to you, if it's okay to carve out an exception, it tells me there's probably a lot of other things that with due diligence could be specifically put into this bill so that we have confidence of what would be and would not be delegated, and we would not be having a situation where people can't have redress to a Board of Education, you know, that is appointed and has responsibility to the entire citizenry rather than some individual where an action may happen and be too late to actually redress.
Thank you. And colleagues, I think we need to move forward. We've
Thank
got
you,
two
Madam
more
Chair.
Bills on the agenda. Thank you very much for coming over, Senator Metzger. Thanks for coming back to the table, Chancellor.
Madam Chair.
Representative Huffman.
Just clarification. What's the plan for today, or will we have a later work session?
We have two more witnesses on this bill, and we will not move this bill today.
Okay.
Zach Martinson and Melissa Unger, please. I suppose I should edit that to say it's not my intention to work this bill today. Welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. My name is Melissa Unger, and I represent SEIU Local 503. And we represent over 4,000 classified staff at the Oregon University system. And we actually are the people who are responsible for the -A5 amendment. And I will talk a little bit about that. But we believe that while the stated goal of Senate Bill 118 is to streamline the work of the State Board of Higher Education, the bill has some broader consequences in that the second section of the bill allows the board to delegate any of its powers outside of tuition setting authority, which was added in the Senate, to the chancellor or the presidents and of the institutions, and that there may be duties that should not be delegated. And similar to what Senator Metzger said, we think that there should be sidebars and conversations about what are those duties that should be delegated and what are those duties that should not be delegated. One of the things that we would be concerned about, for instance, is contract negotiations, which is currently handled by the chancellor and the chancellor's office, but is not something that can be delegated to all seven campuses. I think that there's also things in the statute around hiring presidents, setting compensation for the chancellor and the president, electing a president of the board, and creating a vision and goals. And these aren't things I necessarily think the State Board of Higher Education would delegate, but I think that setting the precedent that they could delegate any of these things is pretty broad, and that while this board may not have that intention, we're setting policy for whatever board or whatever boards may come next. And so those are our concerns with the bill. But beyond just the specific things in this bill, I think that our organizationally, SEIU Local 503 has had concerns over the years that Oregon has trended towards a system of higher education that's more driven campus by campus than system-wide. And our values around higher education are that Oregon has a system of higher education that meets the goals of the state in educating its citizens and meeting the needs of Oregon businesses. And so we believe in a systematic approach to higher education. So the -A5 amendments were kind of my best shot, to be honest, at coming up with what are the pieces in 351 that are administrative in nature, and that makes sense that they would be delegated campus to the campuses or to the chancellor. And we didn't, there may have been an accident if there was a current delegation authority that was then removed. That was not our intention with the amendments. Our intention was to actually look at the bill, and if you look at the current version of the bill, the A. and Gross version, under on page 2, section 22, lines 22 through 23, we added that back in to say you should be able to delegate that, and you should add it. You should also be able to delegate that to the chancellor. Right now, the chancellor is not included in that, and so all of the deleted sections, we actually set, we kept those in and made sure that the chancellor and the presidents were included, because those are the current delegation authority in the statute. And then we went, you know, I went through and said, you know, looked at some of the other sections, and we'd actually be happy to work with the chancellor's office on specific sections that they believe need delegation authority. There currently is delegation authority in some of the sections in the in 351, and so I don't know if I quite understand how by putting delegation authority into certain sections means that you couldn't delegate other sections, because there already is some delegation authority in 350 in ORS 351. So that's but that is how the amendments got put together and brought forward. And like I said, we would be more than willing to work with the chancellor's office figuring out which parts of ORS 351 are the pieces that they really need delegated to be able to streamline their work. And this was just kind of our first work at figuring out what those areas may be.
Thank you, Melissa. Please.
Chair Gelsler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Zach Martinson. Currently, I am the Director of State Affairs for the Associated Students of Portland State University, as well as serving on the Board of Directors for the Oregon Student Association as the Vice Chair, which represents more than 100,000 public post-secondary education students across the state. Before I start my testimony, I did want to clarify real quick. It was not an OSA amendment that struck tuition delegation from the bill. That was definitely an Oregon University System amendment. And I just wanted to put that on the record because it sounded like there was some clarification needed on that. This bill was written to allow the State Board of Higher Education to delegate the chancellor some of the more menial and routine tasks of running the university system. It does that, but it also does much more. With sweeping language, it allows the chancellor to take on any task within the system with the exception of setting fees. This is why we're concerned. The solution proposed in this bill is a much wider and all-encompassing than for that which it was mandated. And this bill, in other words, does more than it needs to do and can be written with, honestly, more specificity. This bill would ensure that there is no statutory guarantee that the Oregon University system would run in accordance with ORS 351.010, which states the Department of Higher Education is to be run under the control of a board of 12 directors to be known as the State Board of Higher Education. Putting into statute that it is legal for an appointed state board to absolve itself of the powers with which it is charged is short-sighted and without the ostensible parameters of the intent of this piece of legislation. For example, and this is another example beyond just tuition setting, in 2005, the University of Oregon decided to sell its Westmoreland housing complex, which was an affordable housing place for students. The ensuing debate and dialogue happened in front of the state board through a democratic process in which students' voices were heard. Does this bill guarantee that the board would ever want to avoid a controversy like this and delegate a contentious decision to the chancellor? Of course not. But it would expand the board's ability to do so and could leave students without a forum for which their voice could be heard. We don't want to be obstructive. We merely want to see a statutory guarantee that the state board retains the power and authority that was intended when it was established. We support the -5 amendments you see before you as a means to retain the specificity of existing statute while also allowing the chancellor to take on more of the routine tasks of running the system. We would also be open to discussing additional sections of existing statute to be given delegational status. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. And colleagues, we have two more bills, so if there are not pressing questions that need to be answered right here, I'm going to close the public hearing and move on to the next bill. Representative Thatcher.
I just have a really quick question. Melissa, could the chancellor have the authority to arm campus security?
Representative Thatcher, this is an issue that we have worked on together in the past. I actually believe that I don't know if that's in this provision or not. I'd have to go back and look, but I do believe that there may be something that they could under this bill.
All right. Thank you both very much. And we will come back and have further discussion about this bill. I think I would be interested in having more specificity around precisely what
would be delegated. Maybe that's not the Dash 5 amendments. Maybe it's an exclusion of what would not be delegated. But it would be interesting to see that information to make sure that the bill is not more sweeping than what the intent is.
Yeah, Madam Chair, maybe I should make a comment so that for a further work session,
right,
the interested parties could be doing some work along the lines of what Senator Metzger said. I'm in agreement with that. I think I would like to see some sideboards. I voted against a bill Friday on the floor because I felt it gave far-reaching authority to people that don't answer directly to the voters,
okay,
and that's a concern of mine.
Okay.
I'm not totally opposed at all.
Does that give everyone a little bit of direction? Great. Okay, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 901. We have two more bills. One has one person signed up to testify. One has many more people signed up to testify. So I'm going to do the one first, and we'll do it quickly. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 122A.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, 122A specifies alternative education programs that student enrollments must be approved by the rest of the school district if the student is a resident in that district. It also specifies alternative education programs that students' enrollment must be approved by residents and attending school districts if the student is not a resident of the district. This also specifies the types of teaching licenses that are valid for teaching in alternative education programs, and it does the provisions apply first to the 2009-2010 school year and would declare an emergency.
Thank you. Ms. Chamberlain.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. This is an agency bill, and the only changes that we requested are on page 2 in subsection 7. The remainder of the changes to the statutory language resulted from legislative council rewriting the existing statute to be more clear. We have no interest in it whatsoever. We have no authority in it whatsoever and cannot comment on it. It looks really busy, but we did finally work out that it does have the same legal meaning that it had before Hannah worked her clarifications, and it is more clear. But to that end, the commission was concerned because we issue a variety of licenses, and for a certain set, people have full preparation, and for partial other sets, they may have partial preparation. So we give a limited license, for example, to people to teach Chinese language or Japanese language, areas that don't have high other areas of licensure. The alternative education programs are intended for children and students who aren't succeeding in the regular education program to have another setting. And it was, I don't think, ever intended that people with limited preparation be teaching in these programs. But our council told us that because the statute was so broad, it said or any Oregon teaching license may teach in an alternative ed program. We're asking that that be narrowed back down to what we think the original intent was, and that's that only fully prepared people may teach in an alternative ed program, except a career and technical ed program that's labeled a career and technical ed program may have a career and technical ed license. And so that's the intent of our requested change.
So basically it says only fully prepared teachers can teach?
Right, and only fully prepared CTE teachers may teach in a CTE program, and if it's a general education program, only fully prepared teachers may teach in that program.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Representative Enderman?
What about thank you, Chair Gelser. What about substitutes? Because sometimes substitutes get put into situations that they're not exactly prepared. Okay, I'll give an example. Our ed teacher who teaches goes to Spanish because they're short of a sub. Is that allowable under the rules?
Chair Gelser, Representative Van Orman, yes. Substitute licenses by scope are allowed to teach any subject at any grade level, but they're never intended to be long-term assigned.
Okay.
And the rules say that if someone on a substitute license needs to be long-term assigned, they need to re-up their regular teaching license. And you can't get an unrestricted substitute license in our state without already having had a full teaching license in some regard. So,
thank you. Any other burning questions? We've got a big bill left. So, Representative Roblin?
Just a short one. I think that the no child left behind
interaction with the alternative ed problems. It's causing other problems with regard to certification of alternative ed teachers. In the past, they could teach multiple subjects, and it's getting to be almost impossible to do that. So I think it's a good clarification. But it's still making it hard for alternative eds to even exist anymore because you need multiple certifications.
Correct. Thank you. Any further discussion or questions? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 122, and open a work session on Senate Bill 122A.
Madam Chair, I move that we send Senate Bill 122A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dimbrough moves that we move Senate Bill 122 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And we're moving into discussion. Vicki, could you come back? I have a quick question just before we send this away. This is not the bill for which there were extensive amendments proposed by Senator Walker, is it?
It is not.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Just checking. So I would accept a motion.
You've heard it already.
I've heard it. Representative Dimbrough moves Senate Bill 122 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any other discussion? No. Is there any objection? No. So the motion carries, and Representative Comp and Representative Harker are excused. So the motion was to move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I asked if there was any objection.
Carries. I think he will carry it as well. That's right.
Okay, motion passes, and the bill will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Roveland, will you carry the bill, please?
I was thinking,
you volunteer people, you get to carry the bill.
I'd be glad to.
Okay, I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 122 and opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 71. Can you give...
Yeah, it could have been on the
very
consent
calendar.
Yes, Chair Gelser, members of the committee, this changes resident school districts for charter schools eligible for special education. Mr. Allen will be giving the more complete summary, so I'll defer to him with respect to this. I understand there's an amendment pending that we do not have right now.
And Morgan, I note that you've noted that you live more than 100 miles from the same location, but I assume you can come back.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education. Some nights it feels like 100 miles, but it's not. Here to talk to you about Senate Bill 71, and in the interest of time, I know there's other people that want to testify. I'll try to make this pretty quick, and then so other folks have an opportunity to speak on it as well. But essentially what we're doing with this is we're changing the district residency for students who receive special education, have IEPs, who go to charter schools outside of their school district in which they reside. So just to give a little bit of background, when the charter law passed in 1999, students who chose to attend charter schools that are not in the district in which they live in, as you know, that does not require inter-district transfer, and if there's space, they can enroll the students, and they become residents of the sponsor district. So if you live in Albany and you want to go to a charter school in Corvallis and there's space, you can do that, and you don't have to get permission from the Albany School District. You don't need an inter-district transfer, and that student becomes a resident of the Corvallis School District. That's current charter law. With the exception of students who are on IEPs, under the current charter law, there's about 14,000 kids that go to charter schools in Oregon. There are approximately 350 students in Oregon who attend charter schools who have an IEP and they do not live in the sponsor district. And they are still counted as residents of the district from which they came. So these 350 kids are treated different than the other 14,000 kids in charter school law for the purposes of residency. So what I think everyone would agree, and the folks that are going to come after me, is that this can cause some delays in services. For example, what that really means is if you're a charter school in a school district, you end up having to negotiate with the district where the kid lives, and what that can mean for a charter school is they might have to, you know, enter into negotiations and agreements with multiple school districts to provide the special education services to these. So they have to notify them that resident students have with IEPs have enrolled. They have to establish inter-district agreements to get state school fund payments, and so this means they have to, their business staff oftentimes have to spend a lot of time trying to collect or invoice other school districts for state school fund payments for these kids that go to their charter schools. You end up having joint IEP meetings, plans, and services that get arranged by multiple school districts, and ESDs get involved in this. And so what you can really have are some pretty complicated contracts and agreements.
Morgan, where are these 354 out-of-district special ed students placed? Are they all at SIO?
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, I believe the superintendent of SIO is here. I believe about 200 of them are at SIO, and the other 150 are scattered through the other 85 or 90 charter schools throughout the state. So,
and so would the impact of that be that SIO then would get the twice ADM, 100% of the twice ADM for students that they already have that live in other parts of the state?
That they already have. Chair Gelser, it's for the sake of simplicity, I'll say yes, but it's a lot more complicated than that. And we could talk about that a little more. I'd be happy to go into the cap waiver and stuff like that. But for all intents and purposes, for special education students, as you know, they get a second waiver, but there's a cap of 11%, and then there's a cap waiver, and there's high-cost disabilities, and there's all these other mechanisms. So the reality is that most districts get about 80% of that second weight for their kids on IEPs.
So one more question quickly just to understand how this would work. Mm-hmm. So say a kid enrolls in, let's just say SIO, since mm-hmm. that's where most of them are. They enroll in SIO in September, and they're there through November. SIO gets the allocation for the kid. It's not working out, so the kid goes back to the district. They're a special education student mm-hmm. with significant needs. That local district in which they live that is obligated to provide them service mm-hmm. now has no mechanism to get funding.
Actually, Chair Gelser, if I'm understanding what you're saying, it's actually the opposite. Let's say a student enrolls in the SIO Connections Academy, and they're from, let's say, Portland. Then the Portland School District still gets the state school funding.
No, under this change. The question is under the change.
So what would happen is if this were to pass, then they would be residents of SIO, and if they left the Connections Academy or whatever charter school it was, then they would become residents of the school district in which they live.
And then my last question before moving on to the other folks, we've had a lot of discussion about the cap, the 50% cap. So those students then would contribute to the number that are under the 50% because they would technically be residents of the school district even though they might live far away?
Chair Gelser, I believe that's correct. And my hope would be that just to be perfectly frank with the chair and the committee, is that this bill is not part of the larger conversation or debate that the legislature and the State Board of Education are engaged in regarding the Connections Academy and online education. So it does impact because a lot of those kids are attending the Connections Academy, but it's not meant to be part of that debate, so I don't want this concept to sort of get caught up into that.
I think it's just it's kind of hard to separate that out mm-hmm. since the vast majority of the kids that would be impacted by this are it's all part of that man behind the curtain, and I'm wondering if any of this was addressed in the work and the overall work that's being done through the state board on how to, because generally students wouldn't be going to charter schools outside of the districts that they live in.
Right. Chair Gelser, it has not been discussed at the board level. I think that this bill was brought forward by the department separately from the sort of connections online debate that's going on. And I think our biggest concern is that what we're seeing is that because the IEP students remain residents of the district in which they live in, rather than becoming a resident of the district where the charter school is, that you have essentially services are not occurring as fast as they can, payments are not sometimes being made in a timely manner, and ultimately the special education students are not getting the services that they're entitled to perhaps as efficiently or as quickly or at the level that they are entitled to. And we think that's a real big problem regardless of whether they attend a bricks and mortar charter or an online charter. And our hope with this bill is that we can sort of frankly, for lack of a better term, cut out the middleman and make it very clear that if they go to the charter school, that the district that sponsors that charter school is responsible for the FAPE and the IDEA and all the other things associated with those special education students. students. And I think our biggest concern is that we're treating, you know, I wasn't here in 99. I don't think anybody here was either, but I'm unclear why in the original charter legislation they did this. I don't know. I've heard people speculate why they did it.
Well,
I think
it's consistent with how we do it for other students. So when I was on the Corvallis School Board, if we had a student from Philomath School District that needed the special education services that were in our district, they would come over to our district. We would enter into a contract with the Philomath School District. They were still a resident of the Philomath School District. They were still part of that count. A payment was made to the Corvallis School District. But because they lived in Philomath and that's where their family was, that's where their community was, that was where they were a resident district. And I would have some concern with doing it differently for inter-district transfers than for charter transfers. And it goes back to that other discussion we were having earlier today. We should be really focused on where does the kid live in a community as opposed to where are the dollars.
And I think, Chair Gelser, our concern is that if you're a student, for lack of a better term, a regular education student, and you attend a charter school outside of your school district, then you become a resident of that sponsoring district. These special education kids were carved out for reasons that are unknown to me, and we think that has caused problems in these sort of complicated contract agreements like you described, where they're, you know, dealing, where essentially you have a charter school or a school superintendent or the district having to go back to the resident district and, you know, hound them for payments or hound them to provide the services because they're ultimately responsible for it. And it can get pretty contentious, especially what we're seeing also in some of the districts that have become charter districts that border larger school districts. We've seen some real contentious things flare up between superintendents of those charter districts and those regular districts about payments and things like that. So,
okay. Are there Representative Edelman?
One of the schools he's talking about is in my district. I'm trying to sort out what this is all about, and I'm trying to figure out what kind of a nightmare do we create if the money goes with the child.
Chair Gelser and Representative Van Orman, I think, in our opinion, and in the opinion of the department, is that we're actually preventing the nightmare of that can sometimes occur under current charter law. It's certainly not happening everywhere, but there, you know, again, I'll sort of go back to, you know, I've talked to a superintendent that where they've had trouble getting payments, and they're, you know, they're constantly fighting to get the payments for these state school fund dollars, or they have these complicated contracts and agreements where they're contracting back with an ESD or a service provider or the district. You'll hear from, and I know there's one gentleman here today who has a charter school down in the Phoenix Talent School District, and they've done a great job of working with the sending school districts of kids with IEPs and have worked out great financial arrangements, and I think that's part of what we're talking about. We're trying to put an amendment together to sort of protect those types of concerns. But I think, you know, ultimately the question for the committee is, should we be treating special education students differently than all the other students that attend charter schools? And in our opinion, we shouldn't, because it delays services. And there's unfortunately the money issue gets brought into this, but our larger concern is making sure that the services and that those kids are entitled to happen fast, and there's no delays, and there's no question of who's ultimately in charge of those kids. They're residents of those schools they attend. That's our concern.
Well, and I'd like to go ahead and call up Mr. Warner, because he's come from far away. We're not going to hold this over until Wednesday, because we have a really full agenda on Wednesday, but we will probably reschedule this for a further hearing later.
Sorry, I look so disheveled. It was warm and dry in Southern Oregon.
Welcome to the wet Willamette Valley.
Yeah, I grew up here. I'm allergic to it. Anyway, my name is Mike Warner. I'm the co-director of Armadillo Technical Institute in Phoenix Talent School District in Southern Oregon. I'm the past president of the Oregon Association of Alternatives in Education. I've been running alternative schools and charter schools for 25 years. Our concern is the two primary reasons that this bill is here has to do with the need on the department, on the part of the department, to have it be more efficient. I've sat with Mike Wilfong and watched him look up a record. It takes 20 minutes. Okay, so that's a legitimate concern, and if there's a way to address this without damaging kids in schools, I'm open to looking at it. The second reason is because districts in other parts of the state, other than ours, don't follow the law, and people don't want to enforce it. Our concern is there are five areas that you absolutely must address in order to not damage a district that has done everything. And I don't work for the district. We're a private nonprofit, but they're one of the smaller districts. This is a district that has worked with me and worked with other districts to make sure every kid gets special ed, either services or funding, passed through. So none of the kids in our school go without it. We have a 30% rate of students on IEPs. Two-thirds of those IEP students come from outside the district. 40% of our students come from around the county. We have students from every school district in Jackson County and a special ed student who comes all the way from Grants Pass. A third of our special ed students are on the autism Asperger's scale. They're high cost, high risk. So here's the problem that you're going to create if you don't do this well. First of all, if you do not hold districts harmless who are in declining enrollment, the districts these new kids come from, we have about 25 kids from out of district. All of those districts next year will be held harmless for that ADM. If there's and now 25 students will be added to the overall rolls of Phoenix Talent that they didn't have before, and if they're declining enrollment.
Mr. Warner, we have about 60 seconds left.
Okay.
The next
what I really like to do, and I'll offer my time, is I'm working with Morgan on it, but I would really like people on this group to understand it. I'm willing to come up any day, any time you want to talk with you about this in detail. I've helped write funding mechanisms for alternative schools when Walter Kosher was here. This is huge, and it has the potential to make sure that you'll never see another charter school chartered by a district in the state of Oregon because of the increased liability costs and risks with it, and because of the possibility of having large numbers of kids, especially in rural areas, coming from outside of the district in a declining district year. That will cost our district next year, if they decline, $150,000. And while people who are dealing with billions don't see that as much, our district sees it as a lot, and they won't be able to replace those funds that we get to provide the services we do for kids now in conjunction with all our other districts. So I'm not opposed in essence to the legislation. I'm opposed to it in its current form. And it needs to needs all of the areas that are in the written testimony addressed.
And so if you had a choice today between the bill as it's written and no bill at all, your preference would be to not move
the
bill and work
preference,
on it.
My preference would be that we need to go the next step, form a working group that deals with all of the issues around charter school, prepare an overriding piece of legislation. We've had 10 years now to see how they work. We were one of the first 12 schools chartered in the state of Oregon, and deal with all the issues at one time. Each time these small bills come up, they create problems in other parts of the legislation. And as long as we keep doing that, there are going to be difficulties. The things I addressed here today aren't all the areas that this will affect. I just dealt with this stuff. So. But I really appreciate the fact that you guys are willing to listen to it.
So thank you very much. I'd urge all the stakeholders to keep talking to each other. We may schedule this for a further public hearing if we have time, but it would probably be good before that point to have some agreement that school districts would be held harmless. And most importantly, again, it goes back to that original thing. Let's focus on the kid and not on the funding source.
And with that,
I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 71 and adjourning the House Committee on Education.
Thank you.